from 1928 to about 1934, and Leon will talk mainly about the 1938 miners' strike. There are three key points that I want to get across. Firstly, the Communist Party, or CPA, was very small when the Depression started, far too small to influence the unfolding events. Secondly, they encouraged industrial combativity throughout. So communists urged a fight back from below. They argued that rank and file workers shouldn't be beholden to their union leaders' conservative policies. And that was their approach both before and after Stalinisation of the party. And thirdly, by advocating a fighting approach, the CPA won a following and became a force to be reckoned with in the trade union movement. The Depression began in Australia well before the Wall Street crash, and when the ruling class saw signs of economic downturn, they went on the attack against working conditions and wages. So there were major disputes in three industries. Each involved more than 10,000 workers. All three were crushing defeats for the union movement, and that shaped the industrial landscape of the ensuing years. First was a six-week nationwide strike of about 15,000 waterside workers from mid-September 1928. Next, the timber workers' strike concentrated in city timber mills. That started in February 1929 and in Sydney lasted until October and in Melbourne wound up in June. A lockout of coal miners in the Newcastle and Hunter Valleys in New South Wales was enforced for 15 months, from March 1929 until June 1930. Communists were involved in all of these battles in some way, but they were too small to have much impact. As you can see in the first slide, they had about 40 members in Brisbane, more in Sydney, but on the coalfields north of Sydney, they only had one group of six members in Cessnock. Nonetheless, in all three disputes, the rank and file wanted to fight and the CPA urged them on. I'll say a little about the each dispute and the communists' involvement in it. The waterside strike was against a new award that was correctly described at the time as pernicious and vicious. It gutted Wharfie's hard-won conditions. Members of the Waterside Workers' Federation were outraged when it was announced, but despite that, the Federation's leadership hesitated and failed to declare strike action. But Wharfies had strong traditions of union militancy, so most branches struck anyway. The strike involved all major ports except Sydney, and it was particularly strong in the Melbourne and Queensland branches. The Communist Party's, next slide please, yeah. The Communist Party's Brisbane branch was the most energetic in this fight, so we'll focus on its efforts for a moment. None of the Brisbane communists worked on the waterfront, but they threw themselves into supporting the struggle and trying to extend it. Earlier in 1928, the CPA had set up the militant minority movement as a means of bringing together workers who wanted to fight for a militant approach in their workplaces and unions. This organisation, the MMM for short, was the Brisbane Communists' main tool in agitational efforts in the waterside strike. The Brisbane MMM issued strike bulletins basically every day from the second week of the dispute until its end, and the next slide has a couple of examples. It served to encourage the strikers, to urge extension, and as a news bulletin. Now, to produce this was no mean feat, to produce this daily for a relatively small group of 30 to 40 members of communists. But that wasn't all the communists did. They also organised with the local Waterside Workers' Federation to hold women's meetings about the strike to involve Wharfie's wives and daughters in particular. They held street corner meetings in working class suburbs to encourage support for the strike. And the communists called on other unions, especially in the transport sector, to join the strike. They made the case in mass meetings of unions that they belonged to. One Brisbane communist, a railway worker named Charles Sweeney Collins, took a stand on the job. And he's looking quite respectable there, but I assure you, he was a rabble-rousing ratbag. So when he was ordered to work a train carrying a cargo of meat to the wharves, where it would be loaded onto the ships by scabs, he refused to do it. So unfortunately, he couldn't convince others to join in, and he got sacked. Now, in order to win, the Wharfies would have needed more people than just Collins to stand with them, right? They would have needed more strike solidarity support. And the strike collapsed largely because of a vicious ruling class attack that fostered large-scale scabbing, but also, I would argue, for lack of support from the rest of the working class. However, the communists had begun to show that they were serious about industrial militancy. Turning now to the timber strike in Sydney in particular, this was against a similarly appalling industrial award, especially against its imposition of a longer working week, 48 hours instead of 44. The timber workers were well unionised, but they didn't have the militant traditions that the wharfies and miners did. Most of them haven't been on strike since 1917. But they did have the moral and financial support of the rest of the trade union movement. However, the New South Wales Labor Council Disputes Committee, which led the strike, pursued a conservative strategy. They restricted the strike to the smallest numbers possible. The communists' record in this dispute was mixed. Although they supported the strikers' fighting stance, the CPA did not oppose the Labor Council's conservative strategy or its top-down approach. They didn't use the MMM to encourage rank-and-file involvement in this dispute, rank-and-file initiative, rather. They did encourage rank-and-file involvement, but, they did, though, encourage activism among strikers' wives through the militant women's group. The CPA didn't have any members in the timber industry in Sydney, but the party's main leader, Jack Kavanagh, was on the Labor Council Disputes Committee and became its spokesperson. So communists were part of the strike leadership. The CPA deserves credit for many of the best aspects of the strike, and certainly the Conservatives blamed them for that. For example, picketing was well organised on a basis of strikers rostered in shifts, and the Sydney Morning Herald considered this a suspicious foreign method that Kavanagh must have imported from Canada, where he migrated from. Communists probably had the bright idea for a protest against an arbitration court-ordered ballot, which asked the strikers whether they'd resume work. Thousands of strikers publicly burned their ballot papers and an effigy of the judge. Mass picketing in the final months, where hundreds or over 1,000 strikers and supporters converged on one mill, was also likely the communists' idea. And they were certainly responsible for a number of fiery actions led by the militant women's group. And on the next one, you can see some of the headlines they generated and the picture of them. But we should be critical of the fact that the communists, and particularly Kavanagh, didn't break with the Disputes Committee's strategy in the strike. It was a strategy that couldn't win during an economic downturn. Not only was the dispute not extended to other sectors, but it was restricted in the timber sector. The Disputes Committee even made dodgy deals with bosses who it claimed would continue the 44-hour week, and they ordered timber workers to resume at those mills. Communists were implicated in this strategy, and they were discredited because of it. But the timber strike was an exception. In other industrial struggles during the Depression, the CPA encouraged not only the fight back, but independent rank-and-file militancy in the dispute. They did so in the coal lockout, which we'll look at now. And the next slide, apologies to the New South Wales people, but that's mainly for the Victorians. That's where it took place. So coal miners in most mines in the New South Wales Northern District, the Newcastle and Hunter Valleys, were locked out because they refused to accept a 12.5% pay cut. The strategy of the mining union's leadership was basically the same as in the timber strike: restrict the dispute to the smallest terrain possible. Rank-and-file miners generally went along with that. But miners, like the wharfies, had strong traditions of independent militancy, and at times they challenged their leader's strategy. For about 18 months before the lockout started, the CPA had been trying to build the MMM among miners with modest success. The party had a group in Lithgow and the MMM a few followers around Wollongong. But the CPA was weak in the Northern District. It didn't have a Newcastle branch. And in the Hunter, it had only an unimpressive group of six members in Cessnock. And I say unimpressive because two of them, including the group secretary, abandoned the struggle at the start of the lockout, so the party had to expel them. So they were starting from a very low base. Now, if you've read anything about the coal lockout, you're almost certainly expecting to hear about how the CPA played a major role leading the struggle. And that's what I expected to find when I started researching it. But the fact is they didn't. In the 1940s, the Stalinist leadership of the party created a myth that they were at the forefront to vindicate their rise to power in the CPA. Historians repeated this uncritically and said the communists led throughout the lockout. However, the four remaining Cessnock communists were in no position to lead. Having said that, the CPA's activity in the lockout is a pretty good example of what organised revolutionaries should do in a major dispute where they're in the minority. I'd say they got the essential points right. They argued throughout that locked out miners should take an active part in the struggle and organise with their workmates to ensure, for example, that no coal was taken off site to be sold. Miners in June 1929 agreed and picketed to that end. They also made the case that to defeat the boss's attack, the dispute had to be extended into a general coal miners' strike. Most of their intervention was propaganda. That is, they argued the best way forward for the miners. Sometimes they got it wrong. For instance, in 1929, they advocated councils of action to lead the fight. And I'd say they made that form of organisation a shibboleth. It was the method that mattered, right, not so much the form. And then under the new Stalinist leadership in 1930, the party attacked the Miners' Federation in vicious terms that the miners didn't agree with, although they were very critical by that point of their leaders. Nonetheless, the CPA gained support on the coalfields as they persistently argued for militancy. The Cessnock communists wouldn't have made an impact on their own, but the CPA was more than its northern district outpost. Their publications were probably the most important means of putting their arguments, both the party's newspaper Workers' Weekly and the MMM bulletin Miners' Voice, which is a couple of examples in the next slide. Lithgow communists, as respected as experienced militant miners, greatly assisted by writing for both publications. While the timber strike was going on, Sydney communists only made occasional visits to the northern coalfields. But once that strike was over, leading communists threw themselves into the miners' struggle. The lockout sharply escalated at the end of 1929 and into early 1930. There was a dramatic confrontation at Rothbury, where police shot at picketing miners and killed one of them, Norman Brown. Thereafter, police occupied the coalfields and inflicted further violence while miners and their wives protested and tried to extend the industrial dispute. At the same time, Jack Kavanagh and his cohort were ousted from the CPA leadership, and the new leaders immediately cabled Moscow declaring their loyalty to the new line. Stalin had declared that capitalism had entered a new third period and that its downfall was imminent. Capitalism had survived the first post-war period, the revolutionary wave that brought workers to power in Russia. The second period of relative stability was over, and revolution was on the agenda again. The main enemy in this era of class against class were the Social Democrats, or in Australia, the Labor Party, and associated union leaders. As the last line of defence of capitalism, they were branded social fascists. They were to be treated as fascism's twin. While this new line was introduced, the Comintern also demanded an unquestioning subservience from its affiliate parties. So discussions and debates that had been the norm previously were crushed. This combination produced authoritarian leaderships, ultra-left excesses, and a destructive sectarianism in communist parties worldwide, including Australia. On the Northern District coalfields, adventurism to match the new line was evident, and communist bravado was met with police repression. Joe Shelley, notably, got a 5-month jail sentence for a speech at Curry Curry inciting violence. Yet the consolidation of Stalinism made very little difference to the CPA's approach to industrial struggle, at least at first. For the remainder of the coal lockout and for several years, just about a decade afterwards, they continued to consistently advocate industrial militancy. Why was that? Well, most CPA members were militant workers, and the Comintern's left turn fit their inclinations anyway. But they continued that approach even after the Popular Front, which Nick will talk about in the next session, replaced the third period in the mid-1930s. The fact that they maintained support for a militant workplace struggle was sharply in contrast with CPs in France, Spain, and the US, for instance, which moved sharply to the right. But in Australia, the CPA was under less pressure because Labor was opposition in federally and in New South Wales, where they remained the strongest. Turning now to the depths of the Depression, the early 1930s, which was a time of massive social and political upheaval. Austerity measures were imposed nationwide. Labor Premier Jack Lang was terrifying the Conservatives, and fascists began mobilising. Unemployment reached record highs, 30% nationally in mid-1932, and it was higher in working class areas, for example, 33% in Fitzroy. Evictions became a mass phenomenon and shanty towns sprang up. Some of the unemployed fought back, and the CPA played a leading role in the unemployed workers' movement, which organised tens of thousands. But while there was political turmoil, there was hardly any strike action, and that was largely because of mass unemployment and the three defeats of 1928-30. But the industrial quiescence wasn't helped by the union officials' utter failure to lead any resistance to austerity. Throughout this period, the CPA called for a fight back. In 1931, the Commonwealth Arbitration Court ruled 10% wage cuts across the board. This reduced wages for about half the workforce nationwide. In response, some union leaders, notably the New South Wales Labor Council, adopted resolutions in favour of a general strike, but did nothing to actually organise one, so nothing came of it. The CPA urged workers to get organised for strike action. Yep, that's on the slide there, and they denounced union leaders for hindering resistance. Sympathetic commentators looking at the CPA's activity during the Great Depression tend to recognise that, well, they did some good organising, particularly in the UWM, but they criticised their overall approach as ultra-left and sectarian. And that was essentially how the communists assessed their own work in the Depression a few years later when the party shifted to the right. However, I'd argue that that approach, it gets things backwards and it really throws the baby out with the bathwater. Yes, their activity was at times destructively ultra-left. For example, throwing themselves into unnecessary fights with the police, and their rhetoric very sectarian. But the core of the CPA's approach in those years, urging a working class fight back against capitalist class attacks, was exactly what was needed. Furthermore, that was neither ultra-left nor inherently sectarian. For instance, a general strike in response to the 10% wage cut may have been unlikely, but as militants generally agreed, it would have been the best response. It was not ultra-left for the CPA to campaign for it. Similarly, criticising your political opponents is not sectarian. The CPA sought to build up a militant union rank and file that was independent of the union leadership. They would have been wrong not to criticise the union leaders who failed to lead resistance to the 10% cut. However, the way the communists attacked the union officials, labelling them social fascists, that was sectarian and pushed potential supporters away from the party. During the during the Depression, the CPA grew substantially, and the vast majority of its members, though, were unemployed. Nonetheless, the party agitated amongst employed workers, consistently advocating industrial struggle in response to various attacks. Their main tool for organising militant rank and file workers was the MMM. It shortened its name to the Minority Movement, or MM, and it had a paper, Red Leader. Generally, the communists aimed to build support for a militant industrial approach within the existing unions. There was one variation, the Pastoral Workers Industrial Union. I don't have time to get into it. That opposed the Australian Workers Union. It led a strike in late 1930, but ultimately it couldn't be sustained. I'm arguably talking way too much about strikes, actually, because there were very, very, very few happening in this period. So the main thing that the MM did, actually, was to take up bread and butter issues on the job and agitate around those, and it built a following that way. But in every sector, they encouraged a fight back wherever there was even a spark of resistance. Like in the textile industry, the Communist Party urged a strike in response to a wage cut in 1931 when there was a cut in response to deflation in line with the war. That's that one in the corner there, that's 1931. No strike action took place then, but in 1932, the same thing happened again. And textile workers at that point, particularly young women operatives who were about half the workforce, they were fed up and they did go on strike. The CPA once again encouraged them through their publications, as you can see, in speeches, and by handing out some 23,000 leaflets in Melbourne. At the Lincoln Spinning Mill in Coburg, some of them spent one night painting MM slogans all over the factory walls. I wish I had a photo of that. Sadly, that doesn't exist as far as I can tell. So despite its efforts, the CPA was not influential among textile workers, though, because it didn't have a presence in the industry beforehand. However, that sort of agitation bolstered their credibility amongst militants in general. The MM gained ground in sectors with traditions of industrial militancy, especially transport. So they built a following in railway workshops, on the wharves, and among miners in particular. They won the respect of militant workers who knew the boss was their enemy and that struggle was essential to defend the rights they had and to win any further gains. So I'll finish up by returning briefly to the coalfields. The CPA continued to build the MM and encourage a fight back from below after the lockout. A leading communist and miner from Lithgow, Bill Orr, became a fixture throughout the New South Wales coalfields. He travelled large distances on a motorbike to agitate and became known as the Red on a Red Indian. That's after the motorbike. Orr was elected the General Secretary of the Miners Federation in late 1933, and in mid-1934, another communist from Lithgow, Charles Nelson, was elected General President. With CPA members leading a major rank and file, leading a major union for the first time in Australia, and with strong support by militant rank and file, communists used their position to apply the industrial methods they'd long argued for. They did so to great effect in a successful strike at Wonthaggi, Victoria, in 1934, which was remarkable for the high level of rank and file involvement. Pretty much everyone in Wonthaggi played some part in bringing that strike to a victory. It's notable too that they also got similar impressive gains in Queensland's sugarcane fields at the same time, but without holding any trade union leadership positions. But as to what happened next on the coalfields, I'll leave that to Liam. Thank you.
Firstly, I want to say, to start my talk by flagging that two things. The first thing is that the rebuilding of the trade unions by the Communist Party in the Depression, and they, you know, and by the end of the decade, they were in very influential positions in the Seafarers Union, the Miners Federation, the just having a brain fart and can't remember all of the unions, but the key industrial unions in Australia is, I think, their crowning achievement, and one that stands in stark contrast to the role that they played during World War II, which Nick will talk about in the follow-up session to this one. And I wanted to talk about one particular strike that they led, which was, it's based on my PhD research, so it has quite a lot of direct primary source from the rank and file themselves, because I was lucky to find a file in the archives at ANU that said the 1938 coal strike rank and file, you know, like the strike committee's records, which is, for anyone who does history, it's a real unique find to find the rank and file records themselves. They're usually done by the officials or by hostile sources like police surveillance and things like that. So that majority of the talk is based on those records. So rebuilding the trade unions and going from the sort of cataclysmic defeat of the 1929 lockout that Phoebe described to then less than 10 years later being able to lead a national strike that was largely successful in 1938 was a significant achievement, and one that affords socialists today all kinds of lessons in terms of how to rebuild the trade unions, but also you know, the kinds of strength that rank and file organising can bring to these kinds of campaigns. So firstly, the 1938 coal strike was described as the best organised strike. That was largely the Communist Party talking about themselves, but I think we'll give them this one. It was a fairly fair description. It was one that really demonstrated the impressive leadership and organisational achievements of a communist-led strike. It was an occasion of rank-and-file ingenuity and energy as local branches of the party, many of them their members embedded in the strike committees of the northern and southern districts. So the northern district is the coal mining areas around Newcastle, Currie and Cessnock, which were in Feeney's map. The southern district is around Wollongong. And they ran a superbly planned and executed six-week strike in 1938. It was largely the fruit of the 1934-33 election victories of the Communist Party officials, Orr and Nelson, but also with those two elections of Orr and Nelson to federal leadership positions, there was also the Communist Party basically taking up or reinstituting rank-and-file groups and rank-and-file organising in the key lodges in the Northern District in particular, but also the Southern District and the Western District in Lithgow. Robin Golan, who's a Labor historian who wrote this really excellent book, I would really encourage people to read it. It's a really well-written, beautiful history of the miners. Describes the leadership of Orr and Nelson as nothing new in strategy that they adopted, propaganda and organisation, but it was carried out with more energy and a clearer sense of direction than at any time in the history of the union. And I think that's a fairly fair assessment. And I think that, like I said, it really upheld the best politics of the Communist Party. However, at the time of the 1938 strike, the Communist Party's official orientation was the Popular Front, which for anyone, and I don't really have time to go into it in very much detail, but for anyone who has an appreciation of the Popular Front, and it's basically a class collaboration strategy where working class interests are subordinated to achieving alliances with elements of the radical bourgeoisie, so-called, that this would stand in stark contrast to a rank and file, from below kind of strategy in terms of building and winning a strike. But I think there was a series of internal things that were going on in the Communist Party that meant that the Popular Front strategy didn't mar, as much as it possibly could have, the overall strategy and direction of the strike. The first one was that Orr and Nelson by 9:30 were already on the outer with the central leadership in Sydney, and that they had, according to the memoir of the guy that would take over from them in 1941, which is a guy called Wells, they had already the CP leadership around the key figures in Sydney, whose names have just escaped me, were already engineering to get rid of them, and they were seen as too loyal to the union and not loyal enough to the Communist Party. So I think that meant that probably gave them a bit of an inoculation against some of the worst aspects of the Popular Front strategy. However, there were other right-wing pressures on them, and you can sort of see that in the resolutions to the strike, which I'll talk about, and I think that is the bureaucratic pressures of leading probably the most powerful and well-organised union at the time, and one that had enormous industrial strength, and particularly industrial strength that was further added to by the fact that Australia was facing, wartime reconstruction of its economy, and coal was absolutely essential. It was basically nothing could function in Australia. No heavy industry could function without coal, and the coal miners were absolutely essential to this. And so that put the leaders of that union in a position where they were having regular meetings with the government, both state and federal, liaising with the bosses, and that whole sort of bureaucratic pressure of being the mediators, the sort of arbiters of negotiating the rate of exploitation in terms of representing their members to the bosses, I think was a significant pressure. So let's turn now to look at the strike, and I'm going to try and whip through this as quickly as I can. I've tried to edit the research I did down to the best bits. So here we go. So the first thing I think that was a useful lesson to draw out for us in terms of the strike organisation was the way in which Orr and Nelson, upon winning the positions in the federal leadership of the union, began campaigning immediately for a strike. They clearly had an idea that there had to be some kind of confrontation with the Australian state and the coal owners to win back the very savage losses that had been inflicted upon them. And they campaigned on a variety of fronts. The first one was just basically going through and outlining the sort of deficits in wages and conditions that the miners experienced, and then also making a political argument about how the arbitration system could not be relied upon in terms of winning wages and conditions, winning the kinds of wages and conditions that the miners deserved and wanted to fight for. And I think that was a particularly important step in terms of trying to lay a political basis to give the rank and file confidence that they could withstand the pressures of going to arbitration and also striking outside what was deemed appropriate and within the bounds of the arbitration system. And the first pamphlet that they published was one called called The Condition of the Mine Workers, and it was a 12-page pamphlet, and it went through in quite a lot of detail a comparison of the Australian mining wages and conditions with their overseas counterparts, making the point along the way that Australian conditions were in many ways worse than what even Italian miners got under the fascist government in Italy and things like that. And so they basically made the argument that if they were organised, they could win back and, you know, and far exceed their expectations. And as they concluded in the pamphlet, Orrin Nelson concluded, there's almost nothing you could not do to improve the miners' conditions if they were well organised. So that was the first thing. The second thing that they did was start to galvanise the various lodges, and this is where the rank and file members of the Communist Party became so essential, and that because the leadership, largely based in Sydney, was able to call upon the ranks in terms of people that would actually try and fulfil and carry out the directions from the Sydney, I think that played some role as well, and so that there was actually people on the ground who could carry the arguments that were being made and articulated from the central leadership in Sydney. And the one in a July 1938 surveillance report compiled by the Central Investigation Bureau, this was the Investigation Bureau run out of the Attorney General's Department. It became ASIO after the Second World War, and it's a wealth of really fantastic insights into the coalfields, because they had spies basically stationed all around the Northern District. But one of the reports to the Attorney General says, the party has at last got the miners to the party way of thinking, and that the present situation on the coalfields gives the greatest opportunity for organisation amongst the women, particularly because of the recent fatal accidents. They countenance the use of propaganda that 90% of the machines in the coal mines are dangerous, and thus creating a scare amongst the men and particularly the women in the coalfields. He further stated, this is the agent, that the accident propaganda has been such a success that recently miners would not return to the pit, even though the leaders had pronounced the mine safe, and that the party leader, who the report is about, exhorted the party leaders to become even more active in the miners' fight because the success was assured. So that there is a surveillance report detailing the way in which the rank and file, backed up by the propaganda that was published from the Sydney, the Common Cause, which I'll show you a photo of in just a second, was able to create a sense of concern and anxiety amongst the workers about things like occupational health and safety and things like that. That was part of their organising drive. And the occupational health and safety concerns were real, and that there was actually a Royal Commission that came out after this particular strike that highlighted the terrible conditions, even terrible compared to like American and Western European coal mines. And I think that the fact that you can see even in that report, the appeals to women are particularly important. I think that's something to keep in mind, because I think that at all times the strategy of the Communist Party in terms of trying to organise the rank and file wasn't just focused on the men in the mines, but also saw women as a really important part of any industrial activity. And I think that is something that particularly came from the political project, even as distorted as it had become by the 1930s with the Stalinisation of the party. The fact that they had a commitment to women's liberation really assisted and developed and expanded their rank and file organising. The other critical issue, and I'll talk more about organising women in a second. The other critical political issue that they dealt with, along with just basically trying to relate to people's sense of grievance about their losses, the things to do with occupational health and safety and appeals to women, was the spectre of mechanisation, which was a big issue facing the coalfields in the late 30s, particularly as, you know, various pundits and commentators on coal mines and various economic forecasters in the government could see that the Australian mining technology was very behind, particularly America and other Western countries, in terms of its lack of mechanisation. There was very few machines, and that most of the coal cut that drove the Australian economy was done literally by hand, and the sort of coal mining technologies that, you know, you read about in Germinal and novels from the 19th century and things like that. And so there was obviously a big push by the bosses and supported by the government, who wanted to modernise the mines, but mechanisation was a significant existential threat to the mine workforce, because it would massively reduce the number of jobs and therefore the livelihoods, and potentially could smash mining communities and reducing and driving people out of work. And so the union took this up, and I think this particularly reflects some of the influence of the sort of socialist politics, in particular of the Communist Party, the way they took up the threat of mechanisation, because the way Charles Nelson particularly was a very public proponent of this argument about, well, we're not opposed to mechanisation, but it has to be under our control, and the union has to oversee the entire transition in terms of the miners who stay in the coal mines, and then also any miners that might be displaced through the changing technology. And so Charles Nelson argued in an article in Workers' Weekly, which was the Communist Party paper, that the prospect of greater productivity produced by mechanisation could lead to shorter working days for all miners, paid annual holidays for those remaining in work, as work was shared amongst the existing workforce. And under the influence of the union, technological innovation could be a humanising force in the mines, where the physical toll could be significantly reduced through the reducing of labour time required to extract coal. Making the argument for mechanisation effectively overseen by the union helped neutralise the threat that it posed by technological development, and made more likely that workers affected by mechanisation would be compensated and also transition to different jobs as the industry developed. But it meant that it gave the union a demand to fight around. It became a key plank of the demands that were then put forward in the 1938 strike. And I think that, I mean, this is just an aside, I think the approach of the union to the threat of mechanisation is one that, you know, I think is instructive in terms of how to confront the, you know, the existential threat of the climate crisis and the phasing out of coal, which is required to happen in terms of trying to solve that, something that seems to be lost on the present leaders of the union. So one of the other aspects of the strike was a sense of a long-term view, that the strike had to be executed in a particular way, that it couldn't, that the leadership of the union couldn't give in to the impatience, and there was considerable impatience amongst the rank and file to launch a strike. You can imagine they've had 10 years, you know, stinging from the defeats of the lockout, you know, literally, you know, nursing their wounds, and there were considerable wounds from the violence that happened at Rothbury during the lockout. They wanted revenge, and they wanted to redress for their depression losses. So there was a lot of pressure from the rank and file on the lodge leadership and the central Sydney leadership to strike. And the leadership obviously had a clear time when they thought it was in their strategic interests to launch the strike. And so the part of the process of galvanising the membership to strike at the appropriate time was a national convention that they held at the beginning of 1938, which basically brought together all of the lodge leaderships and rank and file organisation to Sydney, where they discussed and plotted out how they were going to execute the strike. And it had a really important galvanising effect in terms of on the delegates who then went back and then, you know, argued and campaigned for the strike. And a part of the campaign was also making special levies on the members of the union to be able to raise funds to pay for strike support and relief and to pay strike pay, which isn't always an essential question. And so by the time you get to the end of 1938, as the strike approaches, the key demands of the strike for a five-day week of 6 hours to be recognised as a full working week. So this is them dealing with mechanisation. They're like, okay, you want to mechanise the mines? Let's massively reduce the number of hours that the average working week is. That all piecework is done with a minimum wage guarantee. So that meant they were trying to eliminate some of the exploitative functions of mining, where you know there was just workers were paid on the piece. That the government introduced a special compensation act to cover the mining industry, also with a view to mechanisation, but also I think particularly aimed at compensating miners who were dusted or injured at work, which was an alarming number. That all mine workers reaching the age of 60 years, and you think that's 60 compared to the pension age today, which is 67, receive a £2 a week pension, and that all workers get a 2-week holiday. And the idea of, firstly, a 30-hour week and 2 weeks annual leave was basically unheard of anywhere in the country. The average working week in Australia was 44 to 48. And, some of the editorials that you see in the Sydney Morning Herald were basically like, it's preposterous, these miners, they want to work less than 44 hours. Who do they think they are? You know, and the very fact that we think the working week should be 40 hours, it's obviously not for many people, is a product of those struggles that were happening in the late 30s and early 40s. So I want to turn now to look at the rank and file organising quickly that they did while the strike was going on. The strike was brought to a head when the central leadership of the union served a claim, that log of claims, to the mine owners. The mine owners didn't respond in adequate time, which was to be expected, and then the strike begins in September 1938. And the Common Cause and Workers Weekly have a lot of really fantastic detail about the way in which the rank and file organise themselves into strike support and just, organise themselves throughout the strike. So, for example, there were in Newcastle, this is in some of the things I found in the archives, Newcastle organised 20 lodges to be drawn up into 6 districts, which would be then oversee strike relief and the organisation of those communities during the strike. And each would be controlled by a strike committee, and each with a lodge able to elect 6 delegates to the strike committee. The whole Newcastle area would be governed by a central organising committee comprised of delegates from the strike committees in the Newcastle area. The mines around Cessnock were organised in a similar fashion. The Curry Curry strike committee was one of the best organised, partly due to the presence of a larger group of Communist Party members in the area and a long-standing political tradition. They had over 150 members of the community in various subcommittees, which included propaganda, so that means building support for strike relief, which is a sort of day-to-day organisation of food, social, they had lots of concerts and dances, fundraising, football matches and things like that, sports and the women's auxiliary. The relief committee was always the largest. It was 90 people. And I think it's important to make this point because when I start to talk, it's important context for talking about the women's auxiliary work, was that the relief committee was both men and women. But that, in terms of the day-to-day work of maintaining the strike, it was probably one of the most important committees. So organising women, and I think that the organising of the women, particularly around Cessnock and Curry Curry, was really an important aspect of the strike and its eventual success. And it also, like I said, highlights the communist intervention into the strike. Because in spite of the conservatising pressures of the Popular Front strategy, a commitment to organising women, like I said, remained. And under the aegis of the Communist Party, leading women communists were able to form women's auxiliaries and carry out important strike support throughout the Northern District. In the lead-up to the strike, at the request of the Federation, Grace Scanlon, who was well-known in the area as a communist, was asked to organise women's auxiliary. And their first meeting attracted 50 women attending from Cessnock and Kearsley Shire. The work of the women's auxiliaries was essential to building support and maintaining the mining community during the strike. They published and distributed leaflets, They did house-to-house canvassing, as well as extensive touring and speaking engagements, soliciting support for the miners in the Northern District, as evidenced by the bus fares that's incorporated into their monthly statement of expenditure, because they would get money from the Central Strike Committee and they would report back. And so there's a lovely little document. I couldn't find the photo of it, but this is all the bus fares. And they must have travelled really extensively numerous times throughout the week during the strike. The women's campaigning was aimed at shoring up support amongst workers for the miner, and a radio script written by the Cessnock Women's Auxiliary illustrates how they made their appeal. And the script says, "The position of women is certainly not a happy one, for after all, it is she who has to bear the brunt and perform modern miracles in dealing with bills. Think of the continued mental strain that she is under. Embodied in the miners' log of claims, the women see their salvation. Pensions and shorter hours mean works for their sons, for the rest of the men who have given the greater part of their lives to the industry." "The safety question, apart from the actual benefit to the men in the mines, the reduction of accidents and the protection of their general health also means a lifting of the mental strain on women, because they realise greater safety measures mean less minor and fatal accidents," because that was a massive source of ongoing strain and anxiety for women, was thinking, is your partner's son going to come back from the mine that day? And I think when you see the women's work was really essential, because to any strike success is the capacity to endure. The prospect of being starved back to work is a real one for any worker that goes out on strike. You can see this in the way in which the surveillance reports are obsessed with the question of strike pay. Like all of the surveillance reports I've read, every week they even got special in the later strikes got special warrants so they could go and peer into bank accounts of the mining federation to see how much money they actually had for strike relief, because they knew that if they did run out of money, then their bosses would be in a stronger position. So the fact that the women did so much work to raise money and make sure that the strike funds were buttressed and supported was really important to the endurance of the strike. But I think the most important thing about the Women's Auxiliary is that it wasn't a sort of side operation or subordinate to the strike committee and the work that the men had done in terms of organising in the mines. It was actually an essential political body. The women played a role. And the role that they were able to play while the whole communities were on strike was much greater than they were allowed in times when the communities weren't on strike, when they were much more rigidly bound by the gender roles in terms of cooking, cleaning and reproducing the household, the mining households. So I think that the work of the women was really important. And the other aspect of that was that the women's auxiliaries had representatives on the overall strike committee. So that meant that the women were able to have political decision-making power over the strategic outcomes of the strike through the work that they did in the auxiliary. And that all of the lodges had this structure that drafted in women into the political and central leadership of the strikes. And I think it's a really important aspect of the strike organisation. The other aspect of strike, of rank and file organising, was stopping the scabs. And this was an ongoing problem, particularly in the Northern District, where there was a legacy from the Rothbury shootout that happened, and the whole lockout conflagration was that there was a mine at Rothbury that was did not incorporate members of the Federation. And they continued to work, and it became a point of conflict and tension for the Northern District, because it was, any coal getting out of the mines and going to the city, even very small, had the capacity to undermine the overall effects of the strike, but also undermine morale when, so much of the miners' strength was their ability to shut down the entire economy through stopping the flow of coal. And so it was left up to the Cessnock strike committee to deal with the scabs, and they basically spent a lot of their time travelling out to Rothbury and trying to talk to the workers there and convince them to go out on strike. And the bosses really exploited that. So the bosses would distribute propaganda and things like that, suggesting that the Rothbury miners After they agreed to support the strike and to stay out and to stay away from work, bosses would put leaflets out saying, oh no, they're going back to work, and try and cause trouble in that way. And one incident is detailed in a report sent to the Communist Party offices, where they talk about their activity around the small non-union mines, in which an unnamed author describes how they descended and marched down from Curry, about 300 miners, and the police intercepted the crowd, but the manager allowed a deputation of six to intervene and to go into the talk to the men in the small non-union mine. The miners were in a militant mood and had to be restrained, as it would have taken little encouragement to start a brawl. However, there was a division of opinion on it, and confusion would have been the result of any attempt to march into the mine in a body. So we decided on a peaceful mission and got the men to retire until after the deputation had finished. As a result of this discussion, and one held the following day, half the non-unionists left the job. And so that basically effectively shut down that mine. It was a real success. And it the non-union mines become an ongoing sore for the Northern District, because one of the things that happened in this strike was that they were able to convince the Rothbury miners to support the strike on the basis they would be allowed to join the Federation, and that becomes a bit of an issue going into the 1940 strike. We don't have time for that. But the very fact that they were so organised, and the way in which that the leadership of the strike leadership in the local lodge was able to deal with the sort of the urge of the rank and file to beat up the scabs, you know, nursing that grievance from 1929, I think is a testament to the organisation and political authority that they had. Finally, let's turn now to the strike resolution. So after 6 weeks, the New South Wales Premier effectively held out an olive branch and helped negotiate a settlement. And the settlement didn't actually grant the demands of the program that they'd gone out and strike on immediately. However, they set up two royal commissions and began a new process under arbitration, which led to the changing of an award. The two royal commissions were concerned with pensions and occupational health and safety, and both those royal commissions ended up resulting in changes to legislation that introduced both the pension and better safety mechanisms in the mines. But it wasn't an immediately realised victory. It probably took 18 months to 2 years before that whole process played out. However, these concessions, and they were significant concessions, but clearly not what the strike had initially been based around, were carried to the membership by predominantly Orrin Nelson and the federal leadership group over the heads of significant opposition, particularly in the Northern District. And the newspaper reports of the meetings that voted to go back to work showed that there was quite a lot of opposition and criticism of the leadership for, you know, basically getting, you know, sort of promises but not actual legislative change and the kinds of things that they were demanding. There was quite a lot of debate and discussion at those meetings, but Orr and Nelson were able to win it on the numbers across the whole of New South Wales, and so they went back to work. But rank and file unhappiness about the resolution of the strike was not confined to just the rank and file miners in the various aggregate meetings across the state. There was actually a big fight inside the Communist Party after the resolution of the strike, in which the Victorian leader of the Wonthaggi strike, I would encourage you to read about that, you know, really launched quite a savage attack on Orrin Nelson as being too conservative, too bureaucratic, and relying way too much on the sympathetic arbitration court, which was quite a departure from the sort of whole political basis that Orrin Nelson had been elected upon, in terms of being very critical of arbitration and trying to organise against the sort of pressures of the arbitration system. And so the general thrust of Idris Williams' criticisms was that Orrin Nelson had been far too conservative and had flouted the Communist Party's internal oversight mechanisms that would have, you know, the implications that would have suggested they should have stayed out for longer. And I think that, that it points more to the conservatising pressures of the bureaucratic position, I think, those debates and discussions within the Communist Party, rather than the Popular Front or anything like that. It's really noticeable that there's quite a detailed verbatim account of this discussion that happened inside the Communist Party in the records that I've seen, and it's all about industrial strategy, and there's no mention of any of the other stuff about class allies or anything like that. I think one of the things that the other aspect of the strike, which is really important and you don't see the full fruit of until much later during the war, was the rank and file confidence was obviously given to the rank and file. They had organised the strike, they carried it off, they eventually won a series of quite significant concessions from the government and the arbitration system, and that confidence and self-organisation carried them into the war when they would eventually be end up being pitted against their own leadership, their own communist leadership, particularly when the Communist Party switch to supporting the war, which is what Nick will be talking about in his talk following up from the Communist Party's efforts during the war. But I think that the 1938 strike really represented the pinnacle of Communist Party rank and file organising and achievement in rebuilding the trade unions out of the losses and disorganisation created by the Depression.